climate connection.
So, welcome to the podcast, Harry.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me, Chris.
So, to begin with, Harry, perhaps I could ask a very general question. What responsibility do you think the ELT sector as a whole has towards the climate crisis?
I think we have a very huge responsibility because English language education is kind of the melting pot for what every other subject area does within the school systems. I know there's a lot within the areas of science looking at the different changes that have happened to the environment, but English language and language overall is that tool that we use to communicate all these values that are dear to human beings and that are fundamental to our survival on the planet. And so I think ELT has a really huge role, probably the most huge role in looking at environmental problems and the climate change, because the way we communicate, the different media we use to communicate, the way we engage with people, the discourses that we use can make or mar the planet, because they can shape people's attitudes and beliefs and actions consequently. So for me, ELT has got a really fundamental role, partnering with with science to support initiatives that help us sustain our environment.
And do you think the language classroom in particular is a special place where that kind of thing can happen?
I agree. It is in many ways. It is I think it's Nelson Mandela, if I've not forgotten, who said education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. And language education itself seems to me to be even the most powerful of the powerful weapons within education. As we know, language is a symbolic tool, and the way we use it shapes the way we behave, the way we respond. And the English language class seems to me an ideal place for bringing all this, like I said before, it's a melting pot for bringing all these ideas together so that students are not just languaging, but they're using language to talk about things that are really dear to them and that are dear to their environment. So for me, yes. And there are lots of examples of work that language teachers are doing around the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, to bring that into the classroom.
Have you got any specific examples that you know of, Harry, either from your own experience or sort of other IATEFL members and what they're doing in, for example, sub-Saharan Africa?
Yeah. I'm probably doing the least of all of these. I know I've had a presentation which is online on pedagogies of partnership. It's something that I've been talking about a lot. And I show examples of work that my colleagues in Cameroon are doing with their students, engaging with students to identify themes and topics that the students would be interested in. Because the idea of authenticity has often been built around materials, but it's not often situated in the person. So a text is authentic because it's written without the explicit it's written not to teach English. It's written, say, a newspaper article or a novel. Those are authentic materials, but authentic to whose reality? So the work I've been doing with the Camerata Research Group and my colleagues in Cameroon has been to try and push the idea of authenticity beyond just the material, but to the participants, the students. What is authentic to the students? What are their authentic realities, and how would they want those to be brought into the classroom? And experiences from colleagues have shown that students want to talk about the environment, about garbage disposal in their environment, about cultural beliefs of bushfires and things like that impact on the environment. And when teachers bring this into the classroom, students are engaged, they are motivated, their sense of agency is developed, and they make themselves partners in the process, not just around bringing the materials, but also engaging in the practices, the pedagogic practices that the teacher might want to adapt in the classroom. So those are examples that I know from Cameroon. But if you read, and I really recommend the book edited by Linda Ruas. It's called Creating Change, Global Issues in ELT in Africa. I would really recommend that because it shows, I think, from out of the 22 contributions from East, West, Center, and South Africa, so Sub-Saharan Africa, 809 are specifically developed around issues of the environment and climate change, and particularly linking health, sanitation, and climate change, because sometimes the discussion about climate change can be very theoretical, it can be very scientific, and disconnected from the ordinary folk. But in trying to link that to issues that are current in the students' environment, health issues like malaria, which is one of the top 5 or 7 killer diseases in Africa, a lot of things can happen in the classroom. And so that book shows lots of examples very quickly. And I hope you would be able to talk to people like Ali Jao in Guinea-Bissau, whose work is built around how teachers are bringing health and the environment together. In Togo, for example, the local teacher association, what are they called again? I think they are called Togo English Teachers Association, TETA, have worked together with the Ministry of Education to integrate climate and environmental education into the English language curriculum, addressing a range of topics related to man and his environment. Elsewhere in Nigeria, in Benin, or again in Cameroon and in Gabon, different teachers and teacher associations are working with students and also within English clubs, but also within the language classroom. And in some cases, like in Gabon, actually engaging with rural communities, students are engaging with rural communities to develop sustainable ways of keeping our environment clean and healthy for future generations. So I think there is a lot. There are lots of examples that come from the African English language classroom of teachers' own pragmatic responses working with their students to solve the problem. And I really love Linda's book because it captures something that has not been explored in our knowledge in the field before.
Yeah, and we are actually, we'll be talking to Linda in a future episode about that. So, we will be talking about that. You're making a strong case, Harry, for linking this language learning to real life. You know, it's not something that should just be situated within the classroom, but that the classroom is somehow an incubator of that understanding. But then we need to see the results in the real world as well.
Absolutely. And I think these are recent changes. I went to school, primary and secondary school, so many years ago, and I don't remember topics like the environment and climate change actually being part of my language education curriculum. A lot was about pop stars in the US, in the UK, and I still remember very vividly a topic on Mr. and Mrs. Smith standing by a train station and talking about the weather and things like that, and summer, winter, spring, and things that had no connection with my reality as an African child and an African teenager. But very recently, there's been a lot of change, and that's getting into course books. I've seen some course books from Benin, from Cameroon, from Guinea, Conakry, Côte d'Ivoire, and Senegal. And more the environment and is in care for our environment and climate change is beginning to be a key topic area. How teachers then go ahead to develop that is something that we need to be investing in within teacher associations or as teacher educators or within global associations like IATFL and TESOL International and also regional ones like Africa TESOL, supporting those initiatives and showcasing them.
And in terms of changing the sort of the narrative, often the discussion about the climate crisis is framed as a what the global north can teach the global south. But from some of the examples you're saying here, there's obviously lots that the global north can learn from the global south in this respect. Yeah. So do you see that this could help to change some of our understanding and that sort of relationship, that hierarchical relationship through the climate crisis?
I think so. Now, just let's have some facts here. The global north has probably been at the forefront of this fight because of the media, the powerful media, and all of that. So that initiatives, local initiatives in places that don't have that strong media presence will not be seen. But that's not for nothing. The global north is largely responsible for the environmental pollution. Those factories and industries don't exist in poorer countries. They exist in the rich countries in the global north. Cameroon, or Gabon and Cameroon, for example, are the highest timber exporters in sub-Saharan Africa at the moment. And then you have other countries like Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Liberia, Equatorial Guinea. But most of these go to France. And so France positions itself as the greatest processor of timber, one of the greatest in the world. But that's often timber that's exploited from Africa without the consent of the locals, decisions that are made at very top level without the consent of the locals, and the locals are the ones that are suffering. So I think hugely local populations are victims of some form of economic and environmental destruction by the supranational or international organizations. And so it's only normal that they should be taking the lead in fighting what they have caused on the earth. But I think it's also important. Every battle needs the support of allies and even victims sometimes working to make a difference. And I don't think that victims are only in the global south. In the global north, people are suffering from the effects of the industrial impact on the climate. So I think the narrative has to change. It has to be a collaborative process where we are listening to each other, understanding the facts, the scientific facts, understanding the human impact, but also helping, supporting local initiatives, because it is these tiny initiatives that are happening, for example, in language classrooms, but other subject classrooms, or in small communities, that add up to the big global fight to rebuild and sustain our environment and the climate.
We could talk a little bit, Harry, about language of instruction, so a sort of slightly wider language issue. Now, in Cameroon, your home country, there's been a lot of tension over a long period of time between the Anglophone English-speaking and Francophone French-speaking parts. And that has often resulted in violent clashes, which are directly or indirectly about language of instruction in the education system. I'm wondering if you think, as we move forward and there may be increased climate stresses within Cameroon itself, whether you think this could tip over into language of instruction discussions and that hostility could even deepen?
Well, Cameroon presents a very interesting situation because of its bicolonial heritage with French and English. And the recent, I think over the last 4+ years, the conflict that has gone on it's been represented in many ways. And I wouldn't say it's completely detached from language. Of course it is, but it's not actually a problem between Anglophones and Francophones. It is between an Anglophone community that doesn't like the leadership structure of the whole country, which also includes Anglophones. So it's really not an Anglophone Francophone divide. And there is still harmony between Anglophones and Francophones at local level. that the problem is with the leadership and the elite. And of course, the elite structure is built on a colonial heritage from France, and it's very centralized as opposed to a decentralized political heritage of the English speaking part. But there is also the essential problem of language of instruction, that when people, and that happens in the Francophone as well as the Anglophone part of the country, that when children go to school in a language that carries the culture of another community and imposes their values as best values, then it diminishes their local initiatives and their local cultural wealth. So, for example, when I grew up in the village, we used to go to the farm and work together. The traditional ruler of each chiefdom identifies a piece of land where all the women in the village have to go and work. So they all go there on a chosen day. They map out the piece of land that they would use for their farm. And we children, boys and girls, we have a day we go and work the farm. It was called Ibra. And then after a couple of years, so we went, one Ibra was farmed for 3 years or 3 to 5 years. And there were different types of crops planted over the different years that really matched with how the soil was being used. And then the traditional ruler identified a different Ibra for the next 5 years. Now, while we were working in that Ibra, the cattle rearers reared their cattle in the former Ibra. So the cattle were used to re-fertilize the soil so that we could come back there in 10, 20, 25 years. So there was some local knowledge about how we might look after the environment. But those have somehow gradually been eroded by westernization, and people don't seem farm in that way anymore. It's a bit chaotic, and industrial farming is happening in my local village now in Agem. So I think there's some local knowledge that villagers have about their environment, about how to protect their environment, and that could be brought into the school system if we're using languages that connect the worldview of the community. And even if we were using English language, my example of working in north of Cameroon was bringing locals who could speak English in the community to come talk to my students about aspects of their culture. So that can still happen even in the language classroom, where we get to learn those local wisdoms that our ancestors have developed over time, and use the language classroom, be it the local language classroom or even the English language classroom, to convey that knowledge and to value the knowledge alongside the knowledge that we develop from a foreign language.
And it's one of the challenges of that those sorts of knowledges aren't respected as much as the kind of knowledge that are found in curriculums and in textbooks.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not. But human survival depended on that for a very long time. And even in our modern days, if we may call these modern days, because there are still people who live in abject poverty, we live indigenous lives, they still exist. Those values still exist. That wisdom still exists. And I think we Africa, for me, needs some kind of decolonization of the curriculum, starting from the higher education curriculum right to the bottom, so that we can showcase that value, local value, to the community. I'm a Christian, for example. I've talked about Christianity, and I say there's nothing like a Christian value. It's all culture laden, because what you call a Christian value in the West is not necessarily what people call Christian value in sub-Saharan Africa, in other parts of the world where Christianity exists. So I just think that we need, and it's healthy for human existence and for our environment, that we bring these different values to our understanding of the world, because they give us a bigger picture of what's happening and how we can deal with some of those things we see as issues. Because, for example, if you see wildfires, for example, in parts of Africa, would be because people are burning the bush to the thing, it processes the soil, it makes the soil fertile for them to farm. Now, that's from our perspective, from the perspective of the West, that's not good. But from the local perspective, that's good. Now, we can't just condemn it with our outsider perspectives without thinking particularly of what the values are behind that and how we could then give these locals the what's that? They achieve something from that. In burning the land, they think it fertilizes the soil. So how can we help them fertilize the soil in a way that does not then damage the environment as they are doing? So listening to each other, listening to what people are doing and why they are doing it, and building from that helps us have a full picture of the different activities that we are engaged in our different parts of the world, so that we can have a holistic approach to solving important problems like the climate. What for me is happening now is that people are trying to address a global issue and trying to impose a global agenda based on very localized interpretations of the reality of climate change. And I think a broader view, a broader platform for listening to local interpretations of what's happening could be a good starting point.
I guess one of the challenges of that, it can be both something which happens at a national level, if there's the Ministry of Education, there may be writers there who don't have an understanding of what really happens in the rural parts of that country.
Yeah.
Similarly, if there's a standard issue global textbook written in the UK or the US or wherever it is, they also don't have that understanding. Yeah. So you would advocate that, teachers and students and people from all different areas being involved in the content and the curriculum development.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even within ELT, because very often I wrote course books in the past for primary and early secondary schools, and I don't remember any team of writers, of English language course book writers in my country that included another subject teacher, which is a problem. So I think it cross curricular work needs to be, it's very important. The language textbook should be written by, or at least the contributors to a language course book should actually come from the different subject areas, so that they are verifying the information and that we are including, and that so that the language textbook has all of these threads put together. But very often there are language people and linguists who sit down in a room and think of a textbook and write a textbook. I've often wanted to have different subject teachers, but also students from different subject areas, interested in different subject areas, looking at those textbooks and giving feedback, because that is, for me, one of the best ways of getting closer to the person, person in authenticity that I talked about, rather than just looking at text authenticity.
And I guess that becomes even more important as an increasing number of schools change to English medium of instruction, especially at secondary level. Rightly or wrongly, there's lots of discussions to be had about that, but that is a phenomenon that is happening. Yeah. So that integration is even more important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's just, and a lot of that is happening now in the pandemic. We have seen more and more, it's so difficult to reach students online. So in parts of the world, I think in Peru, for example, maybe Colombia, teachers and where is that? I've forgotten which country in Africa, teachers are coming together and actually developing projects that cut across different subject areas as a way of maximizing the little time they have to access students online.
So do you think, Harry, that with the COVID pandemic, do you think we'll start to see more of a pedagogical shift as well in terms of how English language teaching happens? Whether that's a move to more project-based learning or task-based learning or a CLIL approach. Do you see that as a trend that will be developing?
I tell you what, my understanding of the things that have happened around COVID pandemic and the deaths that the world has seen made me feel at one point that human beings have a spectacular way of not learning from history, because we've had this before. We've had the Spanish flu. We had, SARS before people died. And so the world would have been on the alert. I don't know what happened. And it scares me that we've gone down the same line that we went down before. And I'm thinking, are we ready for another one in the future? But I do think that things have changed anyway. What is hopeful for me is that things have changed. Teachers have seen that there are different ways in which things can be done. My only fear is, have we carried our teacher-fronted transmissive pedagogies from the classroom into the cyberspace? That would be my greatest fear, because if that's what has happened, then we are in for more trouble. But I do think anyway that from the examples of teachers who are doing creative things that I've interacted with and seen in different conference or online presentations, there's been a lot that's happening in the classrooms. Teachers have now realized that they need to work with their students more closely. They need to work with their colleagues more closely. I think parents are beginning to value the work of teachers a bit more. And that for me is a positive sign. The fact that they appreciate teachers tells me that parents would get more and more involved. And that is positive for me in the sense that it opens us up to a variety of ways of doing things and a variety of ways of connecting. And it brings the different stakeholders together in a way that can shape language education going forward.
Yeah, I think a few months of homeschooling for a lot of parents has really brought the importance and value of teachers into sort of very clear kind of focus. And obviously through IETF, Harry, that is one of the roles of IETF. It is about bringing teachers with all those different experiences in those different backgrounds together. You use that phrase before, those pedagogies of practice and so on. So what kind of ways are IETF looking to do that and bring those ideas together? And what do you think teachers can learn from each other about linking language learning to the climate crisis?
Well, from IETF's perspective, since 2019, we made sustainability one of the four strands of our development strategy. The other three are our continuing professional development, our online platform, which is active now but still being developed, and our membership review, which we do from time to time. Now, sustainability became an important part. We wanted to highlight, to make that one of our strategic development plans, not because we had not done so before, but it was an opportunity for us to try and highlight what we've done as a basis for building beyond that. And, you know, there would be no point in having a sustainability strategy if we do not actively do things to make a difference. And I think IETF has done a lot of things over the last couple of years. Our executive director, Joan Button, wrote a short article about this, which should be, I think, in the ELTJ sometimes last year. But very recently, we've done things like actually reducing the amount of paperwork and forms and letters that we print and post to members. You probably know that for a while now, for some years now, we've encouraged our members to opt for digital publications, digital versions of our publications. And we're currently thinking about making voices fully digital as well. We have also extended this to the percentage of members who join and who renew online. They have a high number of them don't ask for any printed forms, and we encourage them to opt for digital things, but digital publications, but also digital membership membership cards. We have been since 2020, we've been using fully biodegradable polybags for our postage to members, for those members who still need publications posted. And there are lots of different things. Even at our head office, we have done a lot of work to make sure that we are protecting the environment. And other practical initiatives. It's a long list. I would like to encourage anyone listening to us to look at IETF's webpage, because we We have a list of things we have put in place going forward to try and reduce our carbon footprint. And we are still open to having suggestions from our members, and we continue to develop that strategy. It's growing. So if you compare, for example, the publication that our executive director, I talked about, which was in October 2019 in the ELTJ, and what we have recently updated on the page, you would see that a lot of other activities have been included. And that's part of our evolving strategy for sustainability and suggestions that we do get from our members.
And it seems as well, a lot of IATEPL special interest groups are also taking that responsibility on themselves. You mentioned the Global Issue Special Interest Group earlier, but other SIGs across the organization are...
The Young Learner Special Interest Group has been doing fantastic work through presentations and the publications and contributions from different members. I think the Teacher Development SIG too, but all I think in a sense, all our associates are doing, our special interest groups are doing a lot of work which we simply don't promote enough. And I think we need to be promoting that, because our teacher education for sustainable development depends on us promoting those initiatives that our members around the world are making.
Mm. You mentioned about young learners, Harry, and this is one of your areas of particular knowledge and experience. I wonder if you could share any ideas and tips for language teachers who are working with young learners, how they can help link the environment to language learning.
Yeah, sure. I think a starting point is to see language teaching as a political agenda itself. Political in the sense that language teaching is value laden. We teach values, we teach human values, and we might decide to thwart the values if we don't want to do the right thing or project those values that are important. So I think for children, we need to start by thinking about what values we want to teach them. Because for children, it's not just about using the language. It's also, why are we using the language? We're using the language to connect, to socialize, to create harmonious relationships with the people around us. And I think that's a good starting point. The other one is also, and that for sustainability, would be learning to learn. Helping children, not just teaching them, but teaching them how to learn so that they can become critical listeners who interact with people, listen and learn new ideas and use them in creative ways. Those two are fundamental to me. So teaching the environment begins by building those values, identifying the values, training our learners to be able to listen to those values and take action. And very little things like their health, their body, and how their body interacts with the rest of the world would be, or their environment would be, good starting points for developing content that is engaging for children, that appeals to their senses and their curiosities and their authentic reality. So pointing out things about them with children, you know that children would tell you, oh, that's not good, that's not fair. You didn't say hello, that's not good, you have got to. So those little values that we bring to the classroom for children are quite important. And the climate, saving our climate and our environment depends on how best we bring these realities into the classroom, supporting children to be able to identify them, to be able to listen to stories or whatever that reflect the environment and make sense of those in a way that is authentic to their reality and taking their own action. I think most of the problems we have now is because there are certain values that we learn at a very late stage in life, when we have already accumulated habits that are counterproductive to those values. And developing those habits from childhood, in a sense, for me, helps in this long-term sustainable way of sustaining our environment, if I might say.
I guess one of the challenges of that is that there's still very strong perceptions in many parts of the world by education ministries, by school principals, by teachers, by parents, that's not the function of language teaching. Learning language means understanding the past simple, the second conditional, the lexical set of transport, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and being then tested on those discrete pieces of knowledge. How do we as a community, as an ELT community, shift that paradigm? How do we change the perception of what language education should be?
I think we have a big responsibility to do that. And that starts with having the right people doing the right thing. I know that language policies are often political policies. They're not always informed by linguists. They're often informed by political situations that we might not know. But at the end of the day, the people who are called upon to implement those policies are often people connected with language. And we have a unique chance to embed all those discrete linguistic items into content that is relevant. The trouble is if we, on our part, go ahead to just deal with discrete language content, then we are selling our bed rights to the wrong people. I think there should be some form of militancy in the way we language professionals work. Militancy in the sense that we are using our understanding of language and how language actually works in society to develop students' learning, bringing those discrete language items that are often measured into the language classroom. So I think we need to look at that in terms of the curriculum, but also in terms of the materials that we design for our students, the textbooks and other resources that we use. How are they related to the students' authenticity? I think there is a bond between every teacher and their students that is stronger than every other bond outside the classroom. And that partnership that we develop with our students is saving. In my own experience, I've actually had to go slightly against school protocols and to develop evidence from working with my students that something else really works. And it is that evidence that made school authorities understand that, oh, there are alternative ways of doing it. After all, the evidence was in the results and in my students' confidence to express themselves in the language in a context where students were struggling with English as a foreign language that's in the French medium part of the country. So we need
I was going to say that, Harry, so you can almost say that you can see the language learning classroom as a safe space where those sorts of ideas can be explored and discussed.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. I think the language classroom is a that safe space outside the politics of policy where teachers and students can actually engage in a meaningful way so that students are learning discrete language items, but at the same time, actually learning about the world in which they live.
And I think for some teachers working in those sorts of challenging circumstances, they can feel, I can't do anything because the government says this, the textbook says this, my school principal says this, and so on and so on. But even then, in their own classroom, there's still so much an individual teacher can do with their students.
Yes, there is. And there is a lot that individual teachers in challenging circumstances can do. And Michael West himself said that in the 60s, that the more challenges teachers have, the more the opportunities for them to be creative. And if you look at people within the field of learn autonomy, for example, Leni Dam, how did she come to learn autonomy? It was from being frustrated with policy and practice and what was happening in the environment and finding her way through. If you look at the origins of task-based language teaching, what Prabhu called the communicational language teaching, it was frustration about policy at that time, and then practicing didn't resonate with the students' realities. And so he started this whole thing he called communicational language teaching approach, which Bill developed into task-based language teaching today. So in sub-Saharan Africa, more particularly, what you find is that teachers in the most difficult circumstances, in the most challenging of circumstances, often are faced with things like large classes, but very often it's low resources. So students don't even have textbooks. And so the excuse of the government wanting us to work with those textbooks doesn't exist to them. They have to create something. And they have created that in very innovative ways. So I do think what we need to do and in our teacher education is supporting creativity. There is no space yet for rapport building, for creativity in the formal teacher education curriculum. It's all about the theories and the technical skills of teaching. But language is not just about the technical skills. In fact, it is far more about the human skills than it is about just the technical skills of how to teach the simple present tense, what grammar aspects to bring. So we need all of that. I think language educators and ITEFL is in a pole position to do this because we have all of these people together and we can actually offer platforms in a more systematic way for people from these different strands of language education to collaborate, to develop ideas and support teachers who are already doing a great job in the context.
Sorry, Harry, I was just saying on that point about learner autonomy as well, it seems so important that teachers play a role in developing the agency of their students, because in many ways, these young people at school now are going to be the ones who have to clear up the mess that previous generations of adults have created for them in terms of the environment. So in that way, we need to shift that pedagogy as well to develop those skills and aptitudes.
Yeah. And I'm really glad that teachers in Africa are doing that. My colleagues in the Cameroon English Language Teachers Association, more and more, they're engaging with students, bringing students' agency to the fore, making students part of the content development, but also the pedagogy that they use in the classroom. And that's something that's beginning to happen, especially in challenging contexts. And that's something we need to be promoting and developing and sharing.
Harry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. And thanks for inviting me once again.
The Climate Connection.